Hello, everybody. It's great to be with everyone tonight. I was finishing up tying up some loose ends with this morning, and it occurred to me that I personally have not done any extended teaching in probably more than a year since COVID started. So I want to thank you all for jumping into the pool with me as I start again. Sean, I think I might need to be co-host or have permission
okay.
to the screen.
I will do that.
Great, thank you.
Okay, you're co-host.
All right, let's see what I can find here. Yes, there we are. So let me see if I can there. Okay, so my topic tonight is archetypal figures. And the more I try to unpack that description, the more interesting and kind of complex it got. So this is a somewhat challenging, but also fascinating area. Simply because there's really such a rich body of literature, art, and history, and there's myriad directions that we could go in with it. So because so much of this is about iconography or representational art in different parts of the world, I've got a number of slides here interspersed with some text to try to keep me on track and maybe to help you all who are at least quick readers or who like to read as well as listen. So let me start out just with this picture. This is in a UNESCO World Heritage Site in China in Sichuan province. It's the Longmen Caves or the Longmen Grottoes, if you will. And as you can see, we have some rather imposing sculptures here, actually carved into the side of the mountain. And apparently it's a major tourist attraction, as many of these places are. This is the Buddha Vairocana is in the center, surrounded by a retinue or company of bodhisattvas. So it was actually seeing this picture that sort of stimulated my interest in this entire topic. So I thought I'd throw that out there first. Okay. Oh, and Sean, are we recording?
Yes, I do have a
clip. Thank you. Just because I always forget.
Thank
you. All right. So some of the themes of the talk here are, first, what are archetypes? I'll try to just unpack that term very briefly. Then we'll see meet some of the bodhisattvas particularly in the Mahayana tradition. There's also many, many bodhisattvas in the Vajrayana tradition and a few in the Theravada and early Buddhist schools. But primarily, we're going to look at Mahayana, which is the stream of Buddhism that feeds our own practice at Blue Heron. At the end of the talk, towards the end of the talk, we'll talk about how bodhisattvas may embody paramita practice. And then we'll look a little bit about where they are right now and how all of this information can inform our own Zen practice and our vows. So now that's the outline. Let's just take a moment or two and just reflect on your own precepts, ceremony, and your own experience, particularly the Buddhist name that you were given and the translation of that name. So just bring that up, just recall that. We'll circle back to that at the end of the talk. If you haven't taken precepts or you don't have a Buddhist name, you can still play the game. In that case, think of someone in your life who has been a particularly important role model to you someone who you knew perhaps as a young person and you saw him or her and said, I want to be like that individual. I want to grow up to be somebody like that. And we'll come back to that at the question at the end. All right. So just briefly, archetypes. We use many words like this in English in passing, and yet I like to sort of unpack them if they're not part of general conversation. So here, the word is really coming from the Greek root archein, which is to rule, and then typos, which means a type. So an archetype is really the quintessence or ideal example of a type of object, behavior, or an idea. A synonym for archetypes might be prototype, meaning an original model of something, or a concept car, for example, for your idea that you may later produce on an assembly line in duplicate. But an archetype is really this idea of the highest, the best, the ideal, that sort of flavor to the word. All right, coming along here. So this is just a tiny side trip into a topic around archetypes, in this case, Jungian archetypes, or those that were developed by the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung in his work as an analytical philosopher. Jung is not the topic of this talk. I'm just using this particular slide to demonstrate or illustrate what some different archetypes might be among human beings or among humans in society. And you could walk around the circle and perhaps see yourself in one of these archetypes or in more than one of them, or you might see someone that you know in one of those archetypes. But these are really just prompts for us to understand how our personalities differentiate themselves within a larger collective society. And one of Jung's ideas is that if we don't have a society that contains all of these archetypes, we're going to be out of balance in some respect. So I think, and I won't say who, but I think within our Sangha, I could attach these labels to a number of different people. You might know someone in the Sangha who fits one of these descriptions. But this is an example of an archetype, and particularly what is on the inside of the circle. Some of these archetypes provide structure. Some of them seek the spiritual. Some of them, I have to turn my head upside down to see, leave a mark. And some of them, what does the other one say? Connect to others. Okay. So those are also important aspects of community life or Sangha life. We need people who provide structure. We need people who are seeking the spiritual life, some who leave a strong impression, and then some who are nurturing connections with other people. So that's a model of archetypes, not our primary one, but that kind of primes the pump. Okay, moving ahead. So some of you, I'm sure, know the writer Joseph Campbell, the American professor from, I think it was Sarah Lawrence College. He had a long career studying mythology and comparative religion. He is the professor in the more popular culture who coined the phrase follow your bliss, which sort of got extracted from the larger context and then kind of maybe wasn't such good advice in some cases. But Campbell is perhaps best known for the work, The Hero of a Thousand Faces, and talks about the hero archetype in different cultures or situations. And of course, for those of you who are plugged into this at all, George Lucas was a big fan of Campbell's and created the Star Wars mythology, largely based on Campbell's work there. There's also voluminous work on Occidental mythology, Western mythology. That's Campbell. He's informed a little bit of what I'm talking about. But there are two quotes here that I really, really like from him. So one, you know, I'll read them. You can read too. But Shakespeare said that art is a mirror held up to nature, and that's what it is. The nature is your nature, and all of those wonderful poetic images of mythology are referring to something in you. And that's kind of my thesis statement as we begin to talk about Bodhisattva archetypes. Another quote from Campbell, the idea of the Bodhisattva is the one who out of his realization of transcendence participates in the world. The imitation of Christ is joyful participation in the sorrows of the world. So there are some Buddhist teachers, I'm thinking particularly of Thich Nhat Hanh, who would call Christ, Jesus, the figure of called the Christ, as a bodhisattva. And in fact, if you recall, you may recall one of Thich Nhat Hanh's more well-read books is a book called Living Buddha, Living Christ. So this idea of the bodhisattva ideal is actually bigger than Buddhist tradition. But our theme for the Kyolche topics has been mythology and metaphor. So I think these quotes are a good signpost into the talk. All right. So we talk a lot about bodhisattvas, but what are we actually talking about? So some of us that have been around the block a few times with the practice have a pretty good idea. But many people really don't. So let's just spend a minute kind of looking at this little list. So we have a Sanskrit word. It literally means one whose essence is perfect knowledge. And that's actually, like all of these translations, it's provisional. But that's one that seems to be good. Again, if we break the word down, we have Bodhi, translating as perfect knowledge, and sattva, reality or being. And of course, Zen Master Zhangji has Bodhi living in her house. Bodhi the dog, the wonder dog, who himself I think is a bodhisattva of some kind. In any case, in the sutras, such as the Lotus Sutra, Vimalakirti Avatamsaka Sutra, bodhisattvas appear as characters that embody archetypal aspects of Buddhist teaching and psychology. And as we saw with the Jungian archetypes, these Buddhist bodhisattvas take on all kinds of roles: sages, heroes, teachers, companions, guardians, etc. Often they possess supernatural or divine attributes because of the integrity or longevity of their practice through multiple lives and reincarnations. They have attained some sort of divine power or status. We'll talk a little more about that a little bit later. But most importantly, and this is where it gets a little tricky to follow all the threads, they cross cultural boundaries. They change names, they change genders, they change forms. But underneath all of these changes of names and genders and forms, there are certain, again, certain archetypes. So really what we want to consider perhaps is that as we meet these bodhisattva figures, we're really meeting figures that demonstrate myriad possibilities for devotion, for imitation, healing, enlightenment, prajna, wisdom. Okay, so that's a little bit of that. So right away, here's a starting visual of archetypal iconography, or this is clearly religious iconography. This is from the altar at the Musangsa Temple of the Kwannon School of Zen in Korea. As you can see, we have the Buddha, but then the Buddha is surrounded by a company of figures, all with halos. These are all enlightened beings, the retinue of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And if you've had any experience with Christian art or mythology, if you subtracted the Buddhas, you would be left with something that you might think was a medieval painting of the company of saints. So we've got cross currents here right away with the iconography around some of these archetypal figures. Here's a basic mandala with our bodhisattvas, and this is from, I believe, the Shingon school. In this case, the central figure is the Buddha Vairocana. All the various Buddhas are a somewhat different topic, but Vairocana is essentially the primordial Buddha, surrounded again by the eight of the main bodhisattva figures in the Shingon school. We'll meet them all in the next couple of slides. But the important thing here to remember is that this representation is actually a basic mandala. And we have the central figure, the energetic or primordial source of the bodhisattva energy and influence in the cosmos, out of which these individual archetypes that surround the source emanate. So again, the center of the mandala is the center kind of womb, if you will, of the Buddhist cosmology, or take a shot here, of the Dharmakaya, out of which the Nirmanakaya, or individual incarnations, appear in the form of the bodhisattvas. And this can get quite mystical in the Shingon school with prayers and mantras and many other things. But that's a really, I think, lovely mandala, basic representation. If I move ahead, all right. We talk about the bodhisattva vows. We said the bodhisattva vows at the beginning of practice, but if we unpack them just a little bit, I've got some noise here where I am. If you hear that, excuse me. We're trying to practice the paramitas in one's own life to advance on the path. A bodhisattva commits themselves to service to others. And more importantly, it's to protect and transmit the Dharma. The sutras are pretty clear and different. The ones that I've read anyway, indicate that there's a little bit of an evangelical flavor, if you will, in the bodhisattvas' work, at least the work of the transcendent bodhisattvas. It's to protect and transmit the Dharma to future generations. So in early Buddhism, if you know anything about that in the Pali, the early schools, we know that beings, human beings, sentient beings are on an endless wheel of samsara, and our destiny is rebirths over and over again in the suffering world. But once attaining full enlightenment, a practitioner or a disciple of the Buddha can become an arhat or an arhant, but then choose a fully enlightened being, but then choose to become a bodhisattva. And in the Pali texts in the early Buddhist canon, one of the phrases that comes up over and over again is when the practitioner becomes the arhant, she or he has done what had to be done. That's a phrase that comes up over and over. They do not re-enter the wheel of life, but rather enter nirvana. This route, this path, if you will, through successive lives, is one that's trod by monastics. It's called the home-leaving path. And as Buddhism spread through Asia and developed, we developed then the Mahayana, or the great vehicle. the Bodhisattva appears more in the Mahayana, first becoming an arhat or an arhant, depending on whether you're Sanskrit or Pali, but then chooses to continue future rebirths for the benefit of other beings. This path is a monastic and home-leaving path, of course, but it's also a layperson's path. And there are many doctrinal, historical kind of threads you could try to untangle with the difference between early Buddhism, what's sometimes called Hinayana or Mahayana. But this is one of the key points, is that the Mahayana puts right out front and center that lay people with regular lives, as we might call them, and jobs and children, can also become bodhisattvas. All right, moving on. Here are our basic archetypes, excuse me. We've got, you can read through them very quickly, perhaps take a few seconds. I don't need to read them for you necessarily. Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, Shakyamuni Buddha, Maitreya, Kasitagarbha, Samantabhadra, Sarvanivarana, Vishkambin, Akashagarbha, Vajrapani. There are many, many bodhisattvas. But the ones that appear here are sort of the what I'd call the star players in the pantheon of bodhisattvas. So we're going to meet a few of these now individually. So we've got Manjushri. I'm going to just skip this here, put you right here. He's often portrayed as a young man, as a prince, frequently carrying either a scepter or a sword. This is a photograph from the City of 1,000 Buddhas in Stockton, California, which is a sort of, I'm not saying this disrespectfully, but it's kind of a Buddhist theme park. It's a Thai temple, which is also something of a tourist attraction. So this photo is from a visit there, but this is Manjushri. He is, if I go back here for a moment, his name means gentle glory or gentle voice. He's typically associated with transcended wisdom or prajna. We generally think he's the oldest bodhisattva in the Mahayana literature. In the Lotus Sutra, he leads the daughter of the Nagaraja, or the Dragon King, to enlightenment. Shakyamuni Buddha then gives him the Vimala Pure Land as a reward for his heroic deed. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, Manjushri is the bodhisattva charged by the Buddha to go to Vimalakirti's house to hear and instruct him. That's a whole separate talk, the Vimalakirti Sutra, that I might do sometime. But he's the only bodhisattva of the entire retinue that is not intimidated by meeting this enlightened layperson, Vimalakirti, and having a conversation with him. It's a kind of a little bit of Dharma comedy in that sutra, actually. Anyway, here's another depiction of Manjushri. Again, he's often as a young prince, and Manjushri figure comes up in fantasy graphic novels even today. I don't know who this particular illustrator was, but this is quite high class anime perhaps. And then here we have Manjushri, the young prince, meeting the Nagaraja, or the Dragon King. So Manjushri in his earlier incarnations is actually an archetype for the hero, again, with 1,000 faces. And he's a very powerful bodhisattva. Here's the last depiction of Manjushri just to share. This was an interesting one. This is called Black Manjushri. you can see here, he has the sword, crown of skulls. So this is a little bit more in the Tibetan or Vajrayana direction. Here he is actually a deity and a healer, which you can pray to for healing from particularly serious illnesses, such as cancer, AIDS, and any number of other things. And the way that healing takes place is that as you clear your mind, as you open your mind to the entire experience of meditation and of the world, you come into a better relationship with the physical condition, the condition of your physical body, and that's the source of the healing. So again, there are many esoteric practices associated with this particular incarnation of Manjushri. All right, so got to talk about Avalokiteshvara next. As this is the compassionate one who hears the cries of the world. This is probably the preeminent bodhisattva in our tradition, certainly in the Kwannon school. This was the bodhisattva that Zen Master Sungsan spoke most about in his teaching, it seems. What's interesting is that the end of the word svara actually points back to a Hindu source. And there's some research that points to Avalokiteshvara in his earliest incarnations as an emanation of Vishnu or of Shiva. And there are representations, I couldn't find one, where he is actually blue, connecting him also in some way to Krishna, who is typically blue in his iconography. So Avalokiteshvara, along with Manjushri, probably the oldest bodhisattva, in a sense, historically. And perhaps the most popular in the Buddhist world. So for example, Chenrezig in Tibet is his masculine emanation. Tara, feminine emanation, arose from a single tear shed by Chenrezig in the myths. And the Dalai Lamas in Tibet are an emanation, continuing emanation of Avalokiteshvara. But then if we cross cultures, we have a gender switch, then she becomes Kuan Yin or Kuan Yin in China, or Kansion or Kanon in Japan, quick translation, goddess of mercy, and then Kwannon or Kwansin Bosal in Korea. And the mantra is arguably the most famous mantra in the world, Om Mani Padme Hum. We hear Avalokiteshvara's name in the first line of the Heart Sutra. And when we chant Kwan Sim Bo Sal or the Thousand Hands and Eyes Sutra, we're also speaking directly to this archetype. I've got four illustrations here. So this one is a very typical Buddhist statue in the sense that it's in a repose. The right hand is resting on, or right arm is resting on the knee. The left hand is sort of extended in an offering. And there is both an exposure of the body itself, particularly in the torso, but covered at the same time. So along with this, we have jewels, the necklace, we have headpiece. This is a very, very typical representation. I think this one's in the Indianapolis. I'm not sure where this one is actually. But in any case, that's a very archetypal, if you will, representation of Avalokiteshvara. But here's another. This is Avalokiteshvara, now Kuan Yin, holding a vase with which she collects the tears of the world, riding the back of a naga, or in this case, a dragon. So that would be perhaps more in the Japanese perspective of looking at well, Kuan Yin would be China, and then again in Japan, it would be Kano no Kanseon. I don't know if this is Chinese or Japanese illustration. Here we have an interesting, very interesting depiction, because we now see Avalokiteshvara with lots of arms and lots of eyes. And the myth behind this particular incarnation is very interesting. Avalokiteshvara, in the realm of the transcendent bodhisattvas, makes a vow to save all beings and will never, ever falter, not even for a single moment in this effort. But of course, eventually he does. There's a moment where he's emptied one hell realm and turns around, looks away, turns back and looks, and the hell realm is then completely again filled. And he says, no matter what I do, I can't make any progress. In that moment of weakness, his head splits into 11 pieces and his arms fall off. So what a way to end your career as a bodhisattva. Except Amitabha Buddha in the Pure Land has been watching Avalokiteshvara, immediately comes to his rescue and in a sense pieces him back together, but transforming his body and giving him more heads, more arms, more eyes, more ears with which to do his work. And so this is, here's another representation of that. So now Avalokiteshvara has more eyes to see, more ears to hear the cries of the world, and many more hands to reach out to those in need of help. All right, so that's Avalokiteshvara. The last thing, of course, we can look at sculptures, we can look at museum pieces, but Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, is still very much a part of the life of children, at least, particularly in Asian countries. This is a cartoon on YouTube I happened to stumble across and enjoyed, the story of Master Shen Yang guarded by Kuan Yin Bodhisattva. So there's a depiction that might connect more with children. All right, here's another one. This is Samantabhadra. And Samantabhadra is often pictured one or the other sides of the Buddha. Not so well known, except that in the conclusion of the Avatamsaka Sutra, Samantabhadra is the bodhisattva that proclaims 10 vows, which are quite extensive. They gradually morph, evolve into what might later become the 10 paramitas in the teaching. But this is the bodhisattva that protects the vows, that protects the integrity of the bodhisattva's mission and path. Often featured riding a white elephant. Sometimes the elephant has multiple tusks. I'm going to go to another photo here. Here is another depiction. This is, I think, I've got it written down here. Mount Enmei in Western China in the Sichuan province. This is the highest of the four sacred Buddhist mountains. And this monument to Samantabhadra sits on the top. This is another UNESCO World Heritage Site. All right, moving on, Maitreya. Just three lines here. Maitreya is the future Buddha of the world. The name is from the Sanskrit Maitri, which may translate as friendliness or loving kindness. In Amitabha Sutra, Lotus Sutra, Maitreya is named Ajita. But again, we have some really wonderful representations of this Buddha. So this is a statue from the Patan Museum in Nepal. As you can see, Maitreya Buddha here is again in a form of a mudra. has the hands, excuse me, in the form of a mudra, deep in meditation. Here's a very different representation of Maitreya. All right, so here we see the future Buddha clad in royal vestment and in jewels. And when I first saw this photo, I couldn't help but think of the Queen's jewels stowed away in the Tower of London. When Maitreya returns, the future Buddha, it's going to be an event like a coronation, perhaps. Some of these, again, representations connect with the human or the earthly conventions that we attach to royalty, to leaders, to great heroes, warriors, etc. So I'm not sure which country this was from. It could be Korean, it could be Chinese, but it's quite elaborate. Very different, and I love this one, very different manifestation incarnation of Maitreya. Here, the fat Buddha, which is often called Hotei. And if you want to have good luck, you walk up to Hotei and you rub his belly. I was astonished to find this slide, though, because this is quite a large representation of Maitreya Buddha. You can see in the right hand, though, the mandala beads, and then in the left hand, there's a sack holding gifts, which will be brought or offered to believers. So the scale of Maitreya is large, apparently. Moving on, Kasitagarbha is usually depicted as a Buddhist monk. The translation here is earth treasury, earth store, earth matrix, earth womb. The operative word here being earth. He's called Jizo in Japan, or Jijang Bosal in Korea. Basically, this is the archetypal figure of one who instructs all beings in the six worlds since the death of the Gautama Buddha until the rise of Maitreya Buddha, the Buddha of the future. And the origin story for Kasitagarbha is one that I can relate quite briefly. In early times, there is a young Brahmin maiden whose name is Sacred Maiden. Her mother scoffs at the three jewels, the three treasures of the Buddha. But then her mother dies and goes to the hell realm because of the karma that she's accumulated. Her daughter is so discouraged and distraught by this that she sells everything that they have in the house to bring offerings to the temple and make devotions to the Buddha of the flower of meditation and enlightenment. These Buddhas have many different names. She does this until she has nothing more to bring, and then she goes home, is still distraught. Then in a dream, the Buddha comes to her in a vision and says, just wake up, sit down, and chant my name, recite my name over and over, and see what happens. So she wakes up, promptly sits down and does this. Her consciousness is transported to the hell realm. She meets the guardian of the hell realm, says, I want to see my mother. And the guardian says, oh, I have good news for you. Your mother accumulated great merit here because of your devotion and your offerings, and she's already left. And she's now in the heaven realm. So Sacred Girl says, great, but then sees all the other beings that are still there, trapped there and suffering. Her compassion grows and she decides that she's going to do for all of them what she did for her mother. So that's a that's one serious bodhisattva. We've got a couple of depictions here of Kasitagarbha, again, often as a monk. You can see here holding a staff with six rings. The six rings, depending on who you ask, are either the six realms or the six paramitas. But then in the left hand, again, is holding an offering to bring to the Buddha on behalf of the person who he's accompanying through the hell realms. That's a masculine representation. Here's a feminine representation of Kasitagarbha or Jidang Bosal. Again, you see the staff and holding the offering in the left hand. Here's Kasitagarbha, a little more of a transcended deity, no longer just a simple monk, but one who has attained really the status of a divinity. And you can see all of the souls in the hell realms who are gazing up to him, imploring him for help out of their predicament. And in fact, this idea of acquiring merit for future lives comes out of this idea or this practice of praying to Kasitagarbha. And in fact, in the Kasitagarbha Sutra, the Buddha gives instructions that says, if you pray and say the name of this bodhisattva 10,000 times, in your next life, you'll be reborn into a life of wealth and prosperity. So this idea of merit and accumulating merit is intimately connected with Kasitagarbha, with Jijang Bosal. There's a long discussion about how some parts of the Zen tradition kind of contradict that idea, but that's what the sutra says anyway. Finally, we've got another incarnation. And who would think one of these things is not like the other? These are incarnations of Kasitagarbha as children. Or as Jizo spirits. These appear all over Japan. And the particular role for Jizo in Japan is to guide the spirits of children that have died before their parents. That's one of the primary roles assigned to this figure. And if Kasitagarbha presented himself or herself in this image of a transcendent deity, I think that would scare the heck out of a young child. So instead, using expedient means, Kasitagarbha Jizo incarnates as a friendly, childlike figure, maybe even a playmate for that young child as they transition to their next life. So that's a little bit with Jizo. Okay, there are many other bodhisattvas as we saw in the list, but that's just giving you an idea of the flavor of what a bodhisattva is and kind of some of the, as I said, the star players in the pantheon. But let's go back to this idea of embodiments. Or archetypes. In traditional religious practices, we know we have saints, we have angels, we have protectors and intercessors. If anybody grew up, particularly in a Catholic tradition, as I did, you know this territory quite well. So we can see some connections there to any kind of religious tradition. So I had asked in the beginning of the talk for if you have a Buddhist name to recall it. And then you might want to take away from the talk whether your name, your Buddhist name, connects to a particular archetype. That's a private question that you can reflect on yourself. I'll share mine. When I received, before I received five precepts, and knew a little bit about the bodhisattvas, the one that I was most drawn to, maybe just by accident, I don't know, serendipity, was Manjushri. I don't know why, but that just happened to be the one that I kind of knew of at that point in my life. And I received the Buddhist name of Heiquan when I took precepts, which meant wisdom life, wisdom light. And I thought, wow, is that kind of a coincidence? I don't know. Which then prompts this kind of a question. If we think about bodhisattvas, transcendent bodhisattvas, are they real, unreal? Are they divine? Do they arise in the moment? Are they just created in our minds? Are they manifested in our actions? We don't want these kinds of questions to help we do want them to help our practice if they can, but we don't want them to hinder the practice. So I think we want to make a distinction between the transcendent bodhisattvas, the ones that I just spoke about, the bodhisattvas of myth and of metaphor, and the bodhisattvas that we might encounter in our own lives, meaning the people who in a way embody these archetypes in the moment. Bodhisattvas appear and disappear, and they appear in all kinds of forms. So I said earlier that Zhongji's dog Bodhi might be a bodhisattva, and I kind of am smiling when I say that, but also I'm a little bit, it's not really a joke. He was a bodhisattva for me when I met him. Bodhisattvas can be babies who bring out your maternal or paternal instinct. They can be friends, teachers, firemen, used car salesmen, even, particularly if you get a good car, first responders. And finally, when we say vows, it means that a bodhisattva might be us, might be you, and that you appear to the world as a bodhisattva, even if you don't know that you're appearing to the world in that way, in that moment. All we need to do is give help without selfish attachment if we can remember to do it in the moment. And if we fail, then we just try again for 10,000 years. So in Buddhism, we remember that all of our beliefs and conceptualizations are provisional. They're flawed and imperfect. But if we want to understand the Dharma and really embrace the Dharma with a big appetite, if you will, then we can meet these archetypal figures and see how they might influence or inspire our own practice. Bottom line, whatever we do, whether we meditate, whether we make offerings, whether we pray to a bodhisattva or just attempt to live an ethical life, we're realizing or manifesting one or more of these archetypes through expressing enlightened conduct in the moment. So with that, I close, and we have a few minutes for questions. And I couldn't see any of you while I was doing the screen share, so you might have all been asleep or having coffee or whatever, I don't know. But I would love to hear your reactions. I will share one last thing just on a personal note. When I first heard Zen Master Qigong talk about bodhisattvas, it was kind of an indigestible topic for me. And I was glad to come back a few years later and try to make my own recipe to, you know, to understand them and then to share them with you. So anyway, the floor is open.
Claire?
I wanted to thank you, Gerald, for this talk, because bodhisattvas have been pretty indigestible for me as well. Yeah. And this really did help me. I think the images in particular made things a lot clearer and made a lot more sense. So thank you.
You're welcome, Claire. Thank you.
Gerald, Thank you so much for your bright wisdom light. I wanted to ask, you know, I was so happy. I think it's Joseph Campbell. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear more about your thoughts and connection to that and more about how you relate that. It's certainly definitely been kind of an inspiration, you know, mm-hmm. for me, and I haven't known exactly how to relate it to our practice.
Well, you know, I was grateful for the theme of myth and metaphor for the Kyolche, because of course Campbell is a fountainhead of wisdom in that area. I think Campbell would say, Campbell was also very much of a Jungian. I only mentioned Jung briefly. But his idea was to try to, this is my own language. So if you think about physics and physicists post-Einstein trying to develop a unified world theory, kind of one equation that would explain everything.
Right.
Campbell kind of seemed to be on that bandwagon a little bit as well with human psychology, with archetypes, and with understanding what it means to be a human being. There are, in some of these myths, he teases out this idea that if you go from culture to culture and from century to century and you keep seeing the same things, that there might actually be something genetic in the way that Homo sapiens keeps repeating these kinds of roles and kinds of appearances over and over. There is also this idea that the bodhisattvas are manifestations of what you might call a collective unconscious or a collective unconscious in the religious domain. Just as the company of saints would be an analog in the Christian domain. I have my patron saint, Saint Christopher Medal. There's not much difference between having, in my mind, between having a Kuan Yin on a pendant hanging around my neck and a Saint Christopher Medal. The function of that archetype is the same. And Campbell was very, very interested in just laying that all out for us to look at. That was his life's work. And then saying to other people, okay, my life is only this long. Here's any number of suggestions. See what you can do with it. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.